Welcome to Gracious Words. Gracious Words is taken from the weekly women's Bible study taught by Cheryl Broderson at Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, California.
We behold your glory, God, in the face of Christ. It shows us who you are, revealing who you are.
On today's program, we'll see how Jacob meets his wife Rachel and agrees to work 7 years as dowry for her. He is in love and smitten, and when it's time for him to see his bride, he experiences quite a surprise.
We will come before you, Lord, in wonder, wonder. We will fall on our knees and surrender. We surrender to you.
And now, here is part one of Cheryl's message titled, A Tale of Two Sisters.
So I'm just going to give you a hint. This morning we're going to be talking about how God takes our disadvantages and turns them to advantages. And that gives me a lot of hope because today I left the house with the wrong notes, without my telephone. And Brian said, I'm going to bring you a coffee, but I didn't know that his timetable was to bring it at 10:15. I like to have it at around 9:15 while I'm going over my notes. And usually one of the girls in the office is so sweet to me to get it for me. But I usually go over my notes. So now I couldn't go over my notes because I didn't have them. And I didn't have my telephone to call anybody. And when I finally borrowed somebody else's phone, because Brian wasn't going to answer from a strange woman, so I found a phone that he would answer. He's like, I'm at Pete's. And I'm like, okay, but I need my notes. And anyway, so then I have a computer here and Laura's trying to get them and they're not coming. And Laura Jackson is the computer genius. I mean, whenever I have a problem, she fixes it for me. She's like wondrous. And she was having problems and I'm just sitting there. I chewed like five pieces of gum because they were there. It's just like, you know, I just, you know, and I'm like, notes, 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 notes. Because I have a couple good quotes that I don't know by heart. And I'm just like, oh. And then as I'm looking at it, I thought, how ironic. I am speaking this morning on how God takes our disadvantages and makes them an advantage. And can I say this too? This is the first time I've worn these shoes. They're from Nordstrom's Rack, and they're giving me a blister on my left foot, big toe. And so thank you. I was barefooted in the office running around. I put these on just for you. Just for you. Not even for Brian. No, if I just slip my foot back, just kind of hang my toe off, I mean toe, heel, that's another disadvantage, getting all the words wrong. But if I just hang my heel off the back, I'm fine. I'm really fine. But I'm glad I've got your sympathies. That's really nice. So I'm going to tell you this just real quick. I titled this, just in case you're a little put off by the chapters you just studied this week. We know one thing, Jacob was a busy man. But I've titled this, A Tale of Two Sisters. Not to be confused with Dickens. A Tale of Two Cities, but A Tale of Two Sisters. In Ecclesiastes 9, verse 11, it says, the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. Nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill. But time and chance happen to them all. Not one of all of the advantages, whether it's swiftness or strength or bread, the right food, or riches, or even understanding, intellectualism gives you an advantage spiritually. That doesn't guarantee success. Brian, we were on a trip and I didn't bring a book. And he says, I've got a book for you to read. It was Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. And it's probably an interesting book. Brian loved it. I fell asleep a couple of times. But his whole proposition is that it really is randomness that makes greatness. But he believes that God is in the randomness, that it really is a spiritual component to why some people make it and other people don't. But it's possible to have every material advantage in life and yet have a deep barrenness that sinks down into your soul. Physical and material advantages can become deficits when you begin to lean into them, work out from them, and seek them to alleviate the sense of barrenness. I remember, I think I was about 26 or 27, looking in the mirror, seeing my first line around my eye. Actually, I went to a makeup counter and said, "Do you have something for this?" And she looked at me and she said, "Ooh." And I looked back and said, "Ooh? Did you really just say ooh?" And she's like, "Yeah." So I went to a different store, just saying. Shoes, different stores. You guys are so with me, I feel it. But anyway, I remember that. And I remember this thought that I had. Like, man, it's time to start working on personality. You know what they say, what's 10, 9, 8, some of you will get this, some of you won't. So those of you over 40, get prepared, maybe over 50, prepare to get it. Those under 50, just go, what? It's okay. What goes 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1? Bo Derek, aging. Yeah. Ask somebody over 50 to explain it to you, and she will. Again, the physical, the material advantages become deficits when we lean into those and expect those to get us through life. Hugh Laurie, who is a successful actor, said, "I don't have a single complete show, movie, or anything else that I could look and say, nailed that one. But endless dissatisfaction is, I suppose, what gets us out of bed in the morning." Ted Duane, I don't know who this guy is, but I liked his quote. "As humans, we are such a discontented species." I love this. "As humans, we're such a discontented species. We're always trying to further ourselves. And you get all the way to the moon, and then it's just discontent. You want to go to Mars." Satisfaction and contentment do not come by way of physical advantages, material advantages, financial advantages, or emotional advantages. True satisfaction, true contentment can only come when we recognize God for who he is, what he does, and his compassion for us. In Genesis 29 and 30, we have the tale of two sisters. The youngest sister had every advantage, and yet a gnawing discontent that brought jealousy, rivalry, and dissatisfaction to Jacob's house. The older sister, who had every disadvantage, found contentment and even joy in the Lord. So let's go a little background, and we'll go to chapter 29, and I'm just going to summarize 29 and 30 as quickly as I can. After having an encounter with God at Bethel, Jacob picks up his feet and heads towards Mesopotamia. Before his encounter with God, he's in flight mode. After his encounter with God, he's in expectation mode. But he arrives, just by the divine will of God, at a field outside of Haran. And he sees shepherds there waiting to water their flocks. And he asks them, "Where are you from?" And they said, "Haran." And he says, "Do you know Laban?" And they said, "Yes, we not only know Laban, but right there, that's his daughter who is coming to water the flocks." Now, it tells us in Genesis 29 that Rachel was a shepherdess. This was very, very rare in the Eastern culture. One, because a shepherdess was vulnerable, because she'd be in the fields with strange men and, you know, anything could happen in the fields. Also, it probably means that Laban's sons, who we'll read about later in chapter 31, that they were too young still to be shepherds. It took extreme energy, stamina, and bravery to be a shepherd. And yet, Rachel is a shepherd. So this speaks very highly of Rachel. Tells us that she had energy, that she had stamina, and that she was very courageous and brave. Jacob, when he sees Rachel, is ecstatic. He tells the other shepherds, hey, water your flocks and then leave. He went some time alone with his cousin. But the shepherds insist, that's not the way we do it. But Jacob has his own skill set. He's been taking care of his father's herds and flocks. He's been managing Isaac's household. So he goes over and he rolls away the stone. He's not afraid of the other shepherds. He's showing off his strength for Rachel. And he is also showing his knowledge of shepherding and defending and protecting Rachel at the same time. Jacob kisses Rachel, he weeps, and identifies himself as her cousin, Rebekah's son. Rachel is so excited, she goes running back to her father. She tells Laban, I've met Rebekah's son, Jacob. He's in the field. Laban comes running out, invites Jacob back to his home. Jacob stays with his uncle Laban, and after a week, Laban says, you know, you really should work for me, and I'm willing to pay you. What do you want me to pay you? And Jacob says, I'll work 7 years for Rachel. In those days, a dowry would be about 30 to 40 shekels. That would be the bride price. 10 shekels was a year's wages. So he is saying, I'm willing to work double for Rachel. You know, not 3 years or 4 years. I'm willing to work 7 years. That's how greatly he esteems and values Rachel. That would have been so flattering to Rachel, maybe. Or maybe she was like, oh, yeah, you should. We don't know. But that was his way of esteeming, saying she's worth 7 years of labor. That was unheard of to offer that kind of price for a bride. Jacob is in love with Rachel, the younger of Laban's sisters. She is beautiful. The Bible tells us she's beautiful in face and form. She's got a great figure and she's got a beautiful face. But it also tells us that her sister Leah has delicate eyes that can also be translated weak eyes. John Corson said something which is kind of cruel. And I've never known John to be cruel, but he said this meant that it hurt to look at her. Other connotations or interpretations are that she was fragile. I mean, she's got this sister that's got all this stamina, but she's fragile. Another interpretation is that she had bad eyesight and squinted. And finally, it conveys the idea that she was not beautiful. Laban hires Jacob for 7 years. The years fly by for Jacob as he works, knowing that at the end he will receive Rachel. He probably started working around 40 years of age or 41, so he is now 47 or 48. Now the wedding night has come, and Laban, no doubt, because it's a wedding feast, those could last for 7 days. He plies Jacob with wine and food and then sends him into a dark tent. Does any of this sound familiar? Then in that dark tent, Leah is dressed up like Rachel. So Leah goes into the dark tent pretending to be her younger sister, dressed like her younger sister. In the darkness, just like Isaac, who had darkness because he couldn't see, and Jacob was sent into that tent pretending to be his older brother, dressed as his older brother, plying his father with wine and savory stew. So at this wedding, after all of the festivities, Jacob's in this dark tent. Leah comes in dressed like Rachel. Now, the wedding night ratified the marriage. You could have the ceremony, but it wasn't considered ratified until the wedding night. So, Jacob awakes in the morning only to realize he has married the wrong daughter. Laban justified his deceit by cultural protocol. In his culture, the eldest must be given in marriage first. Isn't that interesting? It's her birthright to be married first. The fact that her father wants to pawn her off by deceit is also telling. The fact that there had been no suitor for Leah in 7 years is also telling. She is unwanted in her own father's household. She is unwanted by any of the men who live in Haran. And it's a culture that a spinster daughter was considered a deficit. So Laban encourages Jacob to fulfill his week for Leah. Now, they would have a week. Again, this is celebration. But a week was reserved to the bride and for the groom. We would call it a honeymoon. But in those days, it was to guarantee the conception of the first child, to give the wife time to conceive. And no doubt, this is what happens with Leah. Then after 7 days, Rachel is given to Jacob as a wife, and then Rachel has 7 days alone with Jacob to conceive. And Jacob must work another 7 years for Rachel. He works hard for Laban for 14 years. He has two wives who have plans for him. And every day when he comes in from a hard day's work, after watching the flocks of Laban and the cattle of Laban, he has a different sleeping partner. It might be Leah, might be Rachel, might be Bilhah or Zilpah. After 14 years of working for Laban, Jacob is ready to return to Canaan, but he has no wives, but he has only wives and sons, no riches. He has no way to support them, but he's ready just to gather up his whole clan and go back to Isaac. Laban bargains with him to work another 7 years. And Laban says this, "I have learned by divination that God is blessing me because of you." Divination doesn't necessarily mean by means of magic. It could mean that I've divined or I've realized spiritually that I've had an epiphany that the reason I'm blessed is because of you. So Jacob negotiates with Laban. Jacob will work for livestock. Jacob agrees to take the least of Laban's flock, the speckled, the streaked, the spotted. Laban agrees to these terms, but before these terms can start, what does Laban do? He removes all the streaked, the spotted, and the speckled out from his livestock that Jacob will be taking care of. He gives it to his own sons, and he sends his sons 50 miles away so that Jacob will have to start from scratch, because the idea is that streaked will give birth to streaked, striped will give birth to striped. But when you're starting again with solids, the odds go way down that there will be any streaked, spotted, or speckled. So this is, again, this is Laban being Laban, right? This is being deceitful. So Jacob starts from nothing. Now, not to be outdone or outwitted by his uncle Laban, Jacob thinks in his heart, too can play at this game. You won't find that in the scriptures. You just have to have a divine revelation that he's thinking that. But using a combination of folklore and science, Jacob mates the strongest animals together. He peels back the branches, exposing the white. Now, this is a wordplay in the Hebrew, because the word Laban actually means white or whitey. So what Jacob does is he exposes the white of the branches to get the goats and the sheep and the cattle to have spots and speckles and streaks. Now, do you think that worked? No. Some think he's actually thinking it's working, that it's producing this. Others think he's reminding God that Laban cheated him by exposing the white at the mating troughs and saying, "God, you know what Laban has done to me. Get even with him." What it is, we don't know. But it's interesting that during these 7 years, Jacob's wealth increases to unparalleled success. He's exceedingly prosperous with all the disadvantages. He prospers. He gets large flocks. He gets male and female servants. He gets camels. He gets donkeys. in 7 years. He goes from impoverished and having nothing but children and wives to having exceeding large flocks, male servants, camels, and donkeys. That's better than Amazon stock. That's crazy. Now, meanwhile, in Jacob's house, something else altogether is going on. Rachel, who has all the natural advantages, is barren. Let's talk about Rachel's advantages. We talked about her beauty, her perfect figure, but let's talk about her personality. She's got personality. She ran and told her father. She could make demands of Jacob. She's a woman with skills, useful. She's strong. She's brave. But also emotional strength. She's wanted. She's loved. She's esteemed and valued. Yet she has a 9 discontent. Her natural advantages were not substitutes for the barrenness that she carried. And this barrenness that she had caused her to be so jealous of her sister's fruitfulness. She becomes jealous of the one with all the disadvantages. She becomes competitive and she becomes angry. Rachel's natural advantages moved her to seek natural means to alleviate this barrenness. She had gotten so used to leaning into her natural advantages. You know, there's nothing worse than seeing a 90-year-old try to flirt. You know, you're just like, oh, don't do that. Or, you know, no offense, but those older women that are showing off things that should have been covered. You know, when I see some of these aging stars wearing outfits that, you know, bikinis, it's like, no. You know, put those away. You know, don't burn them even. It's just not a good look. But they're still leaning on the past, on what they used to be. I remember there was a lady, she was in her 80s, and when we were in Vista, and I was, I think, 24, 25 at the time, and she came to church with all these pictures of her in a bikini when she was in her, like, 40s, and she says, I have something to show you. You think your wife is so good-looking. Take a look at these. And Brian's like, maybe not. He saw the first one and said, maybe not. I think these would be really good to show your husband. Oh, he's seen them, but I just want to show you. Your wife's got nothing compared to what I have. And he was like, okay. I think there was a little dementia there, obviously. But, you know, to lean into, there are people I have seen that lean into those natural advantages and get used to using natural advantages because they've always had them. It's very, very dangerous. And what we see in verses 1 and 2 of chapter 30 is that she went to Jacob. She blamed Jacob for her problems. She says, give me children or else I die. It's your fault. I'm blaming you. I've got all the natural advantages. This should not be happening to me. It's got to be your fault. But Jacob says, your problem's with God. Seek God. Am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb? You need to go to God. Then she comes up with a plan, not unlike Sarah's, to acquire children through surrogates. This was very common in the Eastern culture, these surrogate pregnancies with the maids. And we look at it and go, whoa!
Jacob worked hard for Laban, 14 years for 2 wives, one he loved and wanted, and the other he was tricked into. As we see the drama unfold, it appears that Rachel has all the advantages. She is beautiful, desired, and loved by her husband. However, she was barren. Nothing could make up for this. She grew envious of her sister, who was blessed with sons. But instead of praying to God, she blamed Jacob and took matters into her own hands. We hope you have been blessed by today's Bible study. For more information about the Gracious Words radio program and the teaching ministry of Cheryl Broderson, please visit our website at graciouswords.com. Coming up next time on the Gracious Words program, we'll see Rachel's consequences as we continue our series, Our Great Creator, in the book of Genesis with Cheryl Broderson. We do hope you make plans to join us. Again, for more information, please visit our website at graciouswords.com. This program is sponsored by Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, California.